This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel, and you're listening to Stand to Reason's hashtag STRask podcast. Hi, Greg. How are you doing?
Hey, Amy. I'm looking forward to the questions. Last time we only got one. Maybe we'll get two this time, but I'm glad we give time to questions that require it. That's all I could say. Some things just require more reflection and more information. So,
well, let's start with a question from Lizzie. Can we invite those of different worldviews / different ideas of sexuality to church / Bible study? Is it wrong to not address those differences at first instance?
No, I think it's a good idea to bring them. There's nothing wrong with bringing them to these things, because in that context, they're visitors, all right? There is a concern if they're going to be part of the community. If they're going to be part of the community, community is defined by certain standards, ideological standards and moral standards. By the way, that is true of any community. Any real community is a group of people united by common beliefs and by a sense of common virtue. Okay, and the left community, the conservative community, the centrist community, the LGBT community, the Lions Club, for goodness sake, you know, these are all different communities that have these things. So people can visit without sharing the ideas that are characteristic of the group they're visiting. However, it might be good in a circumstance like that to inform the person that they are welcome to come, but it's really an opportunity for them as a group to cover some ground that the group leader wants to cover with Christians. And if they have a question or two, it's fair to ask that, because everybody can raise an issue, ask question, contribute to the relevant discussion. But it's not an opportunity to come in and oppose the views and try to get in a debate, because that's not what the group is for. There are other opportunities for that. It isn't like we're afraid of opposition or alternate views. Well, actually, some groups are. But, I mean, in general, what we recommend is that there be a free play of ideas and interaction in the appropriate venues. Okay, but when it comes to a Bible study that's following a certain curriculum or going in a certain direction, led by a leader for the purpose of the standard members of the Bible study, then that should not be interfered with. And unless that particular evening, the leader has arranged for bring your friends who have challenges and questions, and we'll talk about them here. So as long as you're a non-Christian friend or whoever it is that doesn't share all your values understands the basic courtesy guidelines of that particular event, I think it's fine. And I think it can be a very powerful thing for non-Christians to see Christians together interacting in a virtuous, loving, gracious way, especially when they're thoughtful about the convictions they have as they go through Bible passages or some particular topic.
Yeah, it might be a good idea to let the leader know. But Greg, I love your idea of just informing them that you are coming. You're coming as a guest, and we'd love to hear to have you see what we do and to get an idea of what we think. But we do have a kind of an agenda, so we'd love for you to be part of that. But you can always say, well, afterwards, let's get together with the leader and anyone who wants to have a discussion, and we'll just have a discussion afterwards. I know I've always been thrilled when somebody has shown up to a Bible study who wasn't a Christian. That's like the magical moment of the year when that happens. Everybody wants that opportunity to talk to somebody. Well, not everybody, but a lot of people would love that opportunity. So maybe just make sure you say afterwards, let's just have discussion with people. And if you let the leader know, the leader can say, we're going to have more discussion afterwards, kind of an extra long discussion time. And if you need to leave, you can leave. And then that could be a time where they could ask questions. Greg, what about the second part of this question? Is it wrong to not address those differences at first instance?
I don't think it's wrong. I think that a visitor has a pretty clear idea. They're going into an environment where people have different views than they do. They're Christians. In fact, the way Christianity is characterized to non-Christians in most of the places where that non-Christian is going to get information about Christians, and that would be the media or the academy or Hollywood. Most of those are grotesque mischaracterizations of Christianity to make Christians look really bad. So if they have any understanding of Christianity going into a circumstance like that, based on those means of input, then they're already going to be aware of the huge differences, and it's going to probably seem, in their mind going in, much more radically different than it actually is, at least in the character of the Christians and the way they view non-Christians. So I don't think that it's that's necessary. I think that they get it. So I had another thought, though, about warning the leader. And it is, I have it as a personal policy to be aware that no matter where I go to speak, there are going to be probably somebody who's not a Christian or doesn't agree with my views. And so if I'm speaking in a way that is meant to assess or in a certain sense be critical of contrary views, I want to be very careful that I don't do it in a way that is that can be taken as bad-tempered by the person listening, you know, snide, snotty, snarky towards opposing views. Now, I have to keep reminding myself of that because I don't always remember. And sometimes I can just get a little edge of my voice as I'm describing things. And then if the Christians in the audience who are sympathetic to that start laughing or applauding or chuckling or smirking or whatever, well, then I've just compounded the problem. And if there are non-Christians present, it really looks bad. Okay, so I need to keep reminding myself to speak to groups as if the groups were filled with non-Christians or people who disagree with the particular view that I'm speaking of. Okay, this is especially a problem in a smaller group Bible study because it's much more likely that in that study you have all kindred spirits. So if you have somebody coming in who's not a Christian, the leader needs to know. So the leader is very careful to express his own views about Christianity and about outsiders in a way that is going to be the most respectful. And that's a discipline, okay? We're not meaning to be disrespectful, but it's just easy to get to sound condescending to ideas that just seem prima facie, that is on their face, ridiculous or foolish or missing the obvious. And so if somebody's in a smaller group like that, this is where we want to speak in a way that is very careful about that. It should be our standard way of speaking, but if a leader knows that there's a non-Christian present, then they'll be much more careful about how they express themselves.
Mm-hmm. Great points, Greg. All right, we're going to switch gears pretty dramatically here. And go All right. to a question about theology. Here's a question from Tracy. A Jehovah's Witness asserts that Jesus cannot be God because he didn't know the time of his return. Is there a better, more complete way to explain the kenosis, Philippians 2, other than to say simply that Jesus was speaking from his humanity when he said he didn't know?
Well, the reason I'm pausing here is because I think that answer is completely adequate. All right? I think the answer is completely adequate to the task. If somebody doesn't like that, I don't know that there's some better answer that's going to be more persuasive to them. All right? If you're going to critique a view and find fault, you have to find fault with the view itself, not something else. Okay? And on our view, Jesus is the God-man. All right? That means he has human qualities. and he has divine qualities. Since he is one person, that is the second person of the Trinity, with two natures, the native divine nature that he has had from, can't say from the beginning, can I, from eternity past, and the nature that was added to him at the incarnation, which is the human nature. Notice I'm speaking very carefully to get it just precisely right. God didn't become a man in the sense that he changed into a human being. He rather added the human nature to the divine nature in the single person of the Word. All right, so we have the God-man, two natures. And when we read in the text, we read all kinds of unusual. The idea that he didn't know the time of his second coming is only one of many examples of where his human nature is expressed. Jesus got tired. Does God get tired? No. Jesus wept. Does God weep? Only in poems. Okay, he can't weep if he doesn't have a body to shed tears, but Jesus wept, all right? And all manner of human emotions are expressed and behaviors. Jesus walked from one place to another. Does God walk? No, he doesn't walk anywhere, all right? So yet it says that this one called the Word in John chapter 1, who took on a human nature, John 1:14, is the one who made everything that has ever been made, John 1:3. And by the way, verse 3 in John chapter 1 is unequivocal. All things came into being through him. Well, that ought to be adequate. But then John says the same thing another way. And apart from him, nothing came into being that has come into being. So what you have here is, by biblical proclamation, clear, and in the Jehovah's Witness Bible, they haven't tampered with that verse, at least last I looked. So even in their Bible, you have the Word, who is the uncreated creator, verse 3, who became flesh, verse 14, and then that fleshly one had human limitations. All the rest of the Gospels, where all of these human qualities are expressed. Even though there are references that fit his divine nature, before Abraham was, I am. What do Jehovah's Witnesses do with that? Something about Jesus existed before Abraham. And that's precisely the challenge that was offered by the naysayers in John chapter 8. Oh, you knew Abraham, you're not even 30 years old, or whatever they say, something like that. They refer to his human nature, and then they challenge how his human nature could have known Abraham, and he says, before Abraham was, I am, using the egoimene, the Greek characterization that really amounts to Yahweh, I am that I am, all the way back to Moses, the burning bush, and what, Exodus 3 or 4. And so there you have, right there, probably in their own Bibles, a clear, unequivocal reference to two aspects of Jesus, of the person of Jesus, a physical nature and a divine nature. So I don't know why that isn't an adequate explanation of why Jesus didn't know the time of his return at the time he was being asked. I think he knows it now because he's not in the kenosis, or the emptying of prerogatives of divine nature. He doesn't empty himself of his nature. He can't. It's not possible. If you empty yourself of your nature, you cease to exist because your nature is who you are. Okay, he emptied himself of the privileges. He stepped down. He got small, is the way I put it in the story of reality. So I don't know why that's an inadequate response for some Jehovah's Witness. Now, he could disagree with our theology, but he's going to have to do it from the text. The problem is that every time he goes to the text, he finds two different things that seem to be characteristic of Jesus, a human nature and a divine nature. It's all over the place. And the only way to make sense of that part of the revelation, which even a Jehovah's Witness says is from God, so you're not dealing with an outsider here. This is, in a certain sense, an inside discussion since we share a revelation. They've got a problem we don't have because they can't make sense of those verses properly understood or plainly understood. They're not tricky, given their theology of who Jesus is as a created being. But we can make sense of all of them. This is why I've frequently said the Trinity is a solution. It's not a problem. It makes sense of all of the passages. It creates harmony of the revelation.
That's really helpful, Greg, because I think what's behind this question with the Jehovah's Witness is the idea that Jesus isn't God. So that is what is behind the specific question he's asking. So the suggestions you gave for how to respond to that, I think, are really helpful. And you have a piece called Deity of Christ, or is it Deity of Christ, Case Closed?
Yes.
Where you show how to use a napkin and draw a little diagram there from the beginning of John to show how Jesus cannot be a created being. I think that is a great way to go with this one.
Yeah. Given the words, and this is the key here, that diagram is meant to capture the precise language John uses in John chapter 1, verse 3. And you can use the Jehovah's Witness Bible to accomplish the same end. Okay, but it's because John is so airtight in the way he speaks twice and says the same thing from a different angle that there can be no confusion about what he's saying. This point that you have made, Amy, that they start with the presumption that Jesus isn't God, is really important. When you look at the early church, what they did is they started with Jesus. They didn't start with the idea that Jesus wasn't God. They started with Jesus. And they looked at everything he did and he said, and they tried to make sense of it. Now, the earliest, that would be the most primitive characterization of the early church of Jesus, was very simple. Jesus is Lord. Now, when you say Jesus is Lord, they don't mean Jesus is Mr. or Sir. Sometimes when there's a word Lord used, it means that. But this cannot substitute Sir for all the times that Jesus is characterized as Lord. It makes no sense. Okay? And so the early church began to understand that this man, clearly a physical human being, was the Lord. He was God. And they began to understand it because of the things that he said about himself and then the things that he did to verify what he said. And so we don't have a concept of Trinity in our mind and then come back to the man Jesus and impose it on the man Jesus and find things that sound like he's God to confirm our doctrine of the Trinity. Rather, the way it happened historically is the people encountered Christ. And then this was the one they encountered, and it took them a while to try to formulate this in a way that kind of made sense, a couple hundred years, but it was clear they understood Jesus was a man and he's the Lord, not a Lord. He is the Lord. Look it up, all the passages. He's the Lord, declared with power to be the Son of God through the resurrection of the dead. Okay, that's beginning of Romans. That's early. That's what, early to mid-50s that Paul wrote that. He's already declaring the resurrection within 20 years of the resurrection. That's just unbelievable. Okay, so this isn't made up later. What the Jehovah's Witnesses do is they presume he's not God, that he's merely some kind of unique man, and then they go to the one they encounter, the historical Jesus, and try to overlay that on. So this is a great observation you made, Amy, but people need to know that that is not the way the early church formulated their understanding of Jesus. Who would invent the Trinity, for goodness sake? Who would invent that? you know, Ray Bradbury, right? Some science fiction guy. But no one would think of that. Not any Jews, for goodness sake. You know, God is one, Jews, the Shema in Isaiah 6:4. So what they developed this understanding because of their personal encounter with Jesus and with what he said, not because they brought some foreign Greek doctrine in and are laying it over the text.
Mm-hmm. Great points. We actually have more on our website that responds specifically to Jehovah's Witness ideas and theology with suggestions about how you can approach these things. Tim has written a couple pieces on this. So if you go and you type in Jehovah's Witness into our search box, you will find more ideas about how to communicate these ideas to them. And of course, Greg, your Trinity, A Solution, Not a Problem is also a great series you did. I think it's two parts that will be helpful. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Lizzie.
STR.org.
Thank you, Greg.
STR.org. That's how they can find it. Yeah. We take it for granted.
That is also very helpful. STR.org, exactly. Well, thank you, Lizzie, and thank you, Tracy, for your questions. If you have a question you've been wanting to ask, what are you waiting for? Send that in through our website with the hashtag STRask, or you can use Twitter, use the hashtag STRask, and we'd love to answer your question. Thank you for listening. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.